So I want to start with a couple of questions, but I need you to do a little imaginative work here as we get going, okay? First thing I need you to do is I need you to think a little bit about who is the most difficult person in your life, okay? Don't say it out loud. They may be near you, but just think of it, okay? Who is the most difficult person in your life, okay? A similar question. What is the most frustrating situation for you right now? What circumstance, what situation is just the most frustrating thing you have to deal with right now, okay? So maybe you've got a thing or two in mind, maybe you've got several things in mind, but so here's the questions where I want to begin this morning. So question number one, what if the most difficult person in your life is the person who has the most to offer you? What if the most difficult person in your life is actually the person who has the most to offer to you? Here's the other question. What if the most frustrating situation for you right now is actually the key to your deepest joy and satisfaction? What if the thing that you find most frustrating about your life right now is actually the doorway to more joy and more satisfaction for you? Now, if you're like me, these questions will make you cringe a little bit. I want my life to be filled with people who are easy to be around, people who affirm me, people who encourage me. I don't normally seek out people who are difficult or confrontational or negative and critical towards me. Likewise, I'm happiest when things go my way. I don't want to face unexpected surprises. I don't want to encounter resistance or friction or disappointment. I fear failure like most people. And I don't want to hear somebody say to me, "No, you can't do that." And so I would be skeptical if you tried to tell me that I ought to value the people that feel like opponents in my life. I would be skeptical if you told me that I ought to value the situations that make my life hard. And yet in today's reading, King David is confronted by the prophet Nathan. Nathan, of course, is David's enemy and opponent. King David is used to getting whatever he wants. He's surrounded by yes men and yes women. But Nathan the prophet stands in David's path and makes his life difficult. David is accustomed to success and to pleasure, and yet here is Nathan, the lowly prophet, who forces David to confront some of the shadows in his life, some of the harm that he's done, some of the pain that he's caused to himself and others. And I'm sure that David hated Nathan and considered him an enemy. But I'm also pretty sure that Nathan saved David's life. So back up for a minute and just remember how we got to this point in the story. Bob handled some pretty tawdry material, I felt, in a wonderful way with our young people. The young shepherd boy David had risen to become king of Israel. He's in Jerusalem, the new capital, in his beautiful palace. He sent out his military commanders to fight. He had stayed behind at the palace. And while there, he sees a beautiful woman bathing. He's overwhelmed, attracted to this woman. He sends his servants to find out who she is. He finds out that she's the wife of Uriah, one of his valued, trusted military officers. Now, David, at this point, already had seven wives and many mistresses. And this woman, you know, belonged to one of his key leaders. But David's desire knew no bounds. And so he sent his men. He kidnaps Bathsheba, forces himself on her sexually. Later, he finds out that she's pregnant. So he tries to trick Uriah by bringing him back home and getting him to sleep with Bathsheba. But that doesn't work because Uriah is a man of virtue and character. And so when that fails, David sends orders to the military commanders in the field to make sure that Uriah will be killed in battle. And that's what happened. So with Uriah dead, like Bob said, David, King David, has literally gotten away with murder and adultery and coveting and lying and abusing his power and several other violations of the Torah. Now, David does his best to hide all of his misdeeds, but that wouldn't make for a very interesting sermon if we just talked about David the whole time, too. So you know what I'm going to say next. And so do we. We work hard to keep secret any behaviors, any habits with which we don't want to be publicly associated. We might behave in ways that are sexually irresponsible, like David did. We might cheat on our taxes or embezzle just a little bit here and there. We might lie to other people about who we are and what we've accomplished. We might treat people with contempt or disrespect who we consider lower class than we are. We might spend our money unwisely and get ourselves into foolish levels of debt. We might eat too much or drink too much. We might use drugs to numb our pain or to deal with stress. We might struggle with laziness. Or on the other hand, we might work nonstop because we're overly concerned with how other people perceive us. We might lavish gifts upon ourselves in ways that don't leave us enough to share with those who are poor. The list could go on, I assume. I'm in there several times. I imagine you could find yourself in there too. But all these areas where we struggle, these are things that we typically want to keep private, secret, and hidden. These are our secret behaviors. We work hard to keep them out of public light. We don't want other people to see our misdeeds or our moral failures. We don't want other people to see our compromises or some of our bad habits. And so we build our lives so that we can avoid this terrible situation of having other people find out what we don't want them to know about us. Now, this is a pretty draining and a pretty stressful way to live, right? But we do it anyway. Like David, we assume that any pain that we experience at hiding our weaknesses and our wrongdoing from other people, that pain is not nearly as bad as having our dirty laundry aired in front of other people, or this is what we tell ourselves. But even David, powerful as he was, he wanted his violation of Bathsheba and his murder of Uriah to be kept a secret. And he had every reason to believe that those who knew what had happened would never, ever bring it up. So he assumed that he had gotten away with it. It was done. It was over. It wouldn't matter. There wouldn't be any consequences. Nothing to deal with. Just move forward. Now, in truth, we keep secrets from other people partly, so that we can avoid facing things about ourselves that we don't want to know or admit about ourselves. If no one else ever knows that I shoplift, or that I have an anger problem, or that I'm deeply jealous when my friends and neighbors experience success, then maybe I can avoid dealing with that uncomfortable shadow part of my life as well. It's possible for us to keep secrets even from ourselves, and I think that's what David was doing, and I think we all do it more than we'd like to admit. Fortunately for us, God's grace and God's love for us can sometimes come to us in the form of resistance, as a sort of no trespassing sign, a firm no to our desires, our prayers, our plans, and our dreams. God sends the prophet Nathan to King David, and Nathan confronts David and resists him by reminding him of what he's done. Nathan is the one called to channel, to voice God's judgment against David. Quote, "For you did all this in secret," God says to David, "but now I will bring it all out into the light of day." So with Nathan's intervention, David's misdeeds are no longer hidden in secret. David has to deal with what he's done. It's the point of the story today. And there were painful consequences. the story kind of glosses over them, and we even didn't read part of it. There are painful consequences to David's deeds. In our reading, God threatens David that just as David has taken another man's wife, his own wives will be taken from him in a very public way. That's a story for coming weeks. David's son ends up sleeping with all of his wives out in public view. So stay tuned for that. But our reading today did not include the most painful and difficult consequence of all. David's son, born to Bathsheba, falls sick for 7 days and then dies. And the child's death in the story is understood as God's punishment of David. Now, it's extremely troubling for us to imagine God punishing David in this way. Why on earth punish the innocent child? Why punish poor Bathsheba, who has experienced enough trauma already? Perhaps the death of David's child conveys for us, the readers, something like the death of David's hopes and dreams for the future. Regardless, the story reminds us that the God of Jesus Christ has called all of us to live in ways that allow everyone to flourish together. That's what discipleship to Jesus Christ means for us. Learning to see ourselves as God's friends and God's co-workers in God's project of blessing the whole world. So what makes sin, our sin, David's sin, so problematic has nothing to do with the guilt we're supposed to feel about engaging in something that's fun or pleasurable or enjoyable. It has everything to do with behavior that cannot be a part of God's new realm of love, of forgiveness, of compassion, mercy, healing, and blessing for all people and for all of creation. I've mentioned before in sermons this little book of meditations that I use each day when I get to my office. So just a series of short reflections written by William Martin. They're categorized just as thoughts. So here's thought 69, which he titles simply Opposition. I hate when I sit down in my office and this is the one I read. If someone opposes your plans, do not think that you have an enemy. You will have an enemy only if you make him so in your heart. Wait and see. Perhaps your opponent is an angel sent from God to show you more subtle and deeper aspects of the word. Let your so-called opponent show his true intention. If he's truly in opposition to you, your waiting and patience and lack of attack will give you the victory that redeems you both. I hate these. But then he closes with this little observation, quote, "My opponent is not my enemy. He is a gift of God to help me refine my spirit." Then he asks this question, "What opposition are you facing right now?" And then one more word, "Wonderful." So when I asked you earlier about the most difficult person in your life, who came to mind for you? When I ask you about the most frustrating situation for you right now, where did your mind go? Now, what would happen if you could shift into a new perspective, a different way of making sense of all this, no longer seeing yourself fighting against this person, engaged in some kind of battle, no longer fighting against this situation, pushing it away from you? What if you could shift to seeing it in a new way, so now welcoming this difficult person or this difficult situation as part of a life in which God is at work to refine your spirit and make you more patient, more loving, more kind, more generous, more understanding of the struggles that other people have? It's probably impossible for us to hear a story about a power-hungry, self-aggrandizing, Bathsheba-grabbing King David and not think of our current president. I'll admit there are more than a few similarities between David's troubling behavior and that of a president who becomes furious whenever he faces any limitation, any resistance, any criticism, even any factual reporting by journalists who are doing their job. We are learning once again about the way that selfish power often does its work in secret. It was deeply naive of us as the American voting public not to require candidate Trump to release his tax returns so that we could know how he generates revenue and to whom he owes money. But even someone like me, deeply disappointed in our current president, has to believe that change is possible. That change is possible for him. That change is possible for all of us. That change is possible for people like me. When Nathan confronted David, when he pointed out troubling facts that David didn't want to hear, he did so in the hopes that King David would change. And much to our surprise, he did. "I have sinned," was David's response to Nathan. "I have sinned." Can you look at your life and find examples of resistance that ultimately served you well, even if it was difficult at the time? I sure can. Sometimes we change by a gentle, graceful welling up of a new desire to move forward for a new and better life. But sometimes we change just because we get caught, because someone calls us on our stuff. God's love comes to us both ways. When I was in high school, my brother Aaron and I were playing tennis late at night when there were courts by the city pool. We played until about midnight. It was hot, so when we were done, we just took off our shoes and shirts, climbed over the pool fence to take a cool dip in the pool. And just when we'd gotten over the fence, it took a while because it's a tall fence, just when our feet hit the other side, a bright light shone in our eyes and the police car turned on its siren. The policeman had been parked right there at the top of the pool, watching us the whole time, but waited for us to take off our clothes, get over the fence, before he shined the light. Is that part of the training or what? I don't know why he did that. But notice what happened. We wanted to cross a boundary line, and we assumed it wasn't any big deal, right? And someone else said, "No, that fence is there for a reason. Don't cross it." I happen to be married to a person who sees it as part of her personal mission to resist various schemes of mine. I half-jokingly refer to her as the dream killer. But truth be told, some of my dreams are pretty dumb, and I'm fortunate that she points that out to me. I can get easily bored and restless in life, and so I often concoct strategies that involve risk, adventure, or change, novelty, just because I need a jolt of something new and different. Well, that kind of behavior, unchecked, could lead to real foolishness. But she's my Nathan, my dear, annoying Nathan, who stands in my way and asks me the hard questions that I don't want to hear. I've experienced resistance in all different kinds of ways in my life. I'm sure you have too. I've been frustrated by the advice of spiritual directors who questioned my motives, by counselors who have suggested that I should quit complaining and take more responsibility for my life, by job performance reviews from superiors who had the audacity to suggest that I was good at some things and not very good at others. I've experienced resistance from some of you who have reminded me that we have to stay positive and hopeful and moving forward, even in difficult cultural moments like this one. God's love and God's grace have often come to me in the form of resistance, of challenge, even of criticism. And I'm thankful for it. Usually, I'm thankful for it. So friends, God loves you enough to resist you when you need to be resisted. And if you keep your heart open, you can confess with David, "Yep, I have sinned." This isn't some form of religious self-hatred. This is instead a flash of insight that deepens and reaffirms our dignity and our nobility as God's friends. We have been invited to help create a world of love and a world of blessing. Thank God we have people. Thank God we have situations that invite us back onto the path of life when we leave it. Amen.